Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, allies, and students scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 1st of May, 2013. This is Nav Briefing number 61, and the title is Chinnamasta's Glory. As those of you who follow these briefings know, the practice of the Gaia Navigation Experiment unfolds in close observation of terrestrial, lunar, and sidereal factors. So we work in the time frame of the cosmos. The practice of this experiment, the adventure and discovery of this experiment, unfolds within the time frame of the natural world and of the supernatural world as well. And both the natural world and the supernatural world come together in cycles. They come together in the factor of what is called in the ancient Sanskrit teachings, sattva, which can be translated as rhythm. And in the rhythms of nature, supernature is present. Or you could equally say that in the rhythms of supernature, nature is present. So rhythm is the unitary factor. This is a teaching of Planetary Tantra and may be related to previous teachings or previous practices that you have encountered here and there through your life. For instance, I recall that during my years of close association with Anthroposophy, that is the movement founded by Rudolf Steiner, there was a lot of talk about rhythm, rhythmic massage, the rhythm of the flow forms, that is to say, forms, vegetally shaped forms through which water flows, and then in the course of adapting to those forms, it assumes a particular rhythm, and that rhythm cleanses the water and enhances and augments the properties that are naturally present in water. I'm citing examples here from my own experience of studies that have been done on the importance of rhythm. Now, with this talk regarding Chinnamasta, I would invite you to discover an even deeper meaning in rhythm and to investigate in a new way the power of rhythm, especially as it refers to the GNE and to the larger perspective of Planetary Tantra. So in that respect, let me situate this talk immediately in the framework of time based on the calendar we use for the GNE. And just let me add here a short note that just flashed through my mind. Rhythm is, of course, the essence of astrology as well. And having been a professional astrologer for some 30 years of my life, I was deeply engaged in the study of these lunar planetary rhythms and even of the sidereal rhythms, which are the larger scale rhythms involved with the precession of the equinox or involved with the cycles of the outermost planets, which range from 172-year periods out to 490-year periods. Those are rhythms that I've studied. Another really significant and fascinating rhythm in astrology is the 18.6-year rhythm of the lunar nodes. You could devote your entire life to specializing in the study of that rhythm and the way it operates in human development. I have the evidence to show that professional psychologists call developmental psychology, that is the evolution of the person from birth to death, the evolution of the individual human person, if you will, can be plotted on the rhythm of the lunar nodes in a most significant fashion. And so there are many rhythms to study in astrology, and I would even go so far as to say that rhythm is the secret of astrology and explains how it works. Because one observation I would leave you with is that no practicing astrologer today can tell you why astrology works. Did you know that? And I'm speaking now about simply about conventional astrology, okay? Tropical astrology, as it's called, sun sign astrology. So you go to the typical sun sign astrologer, they'll say, you know, you're a Gemini with a moon in Scorpio and Capricorn rising, and you have this and that and the other thing. And if that astrologer is a well-trained professional, he or she can provide you with a stunning profile of your psychological makeup drawn from the astrology chart, the birth chart, which I called the teroscope, replacing the horoscope. And how can the astrologer do that? Well, no astrologer can explain why astrology works. But I can tell you now that it works not because the planets influence humans' behavior, absolutely not. I greatly admired and followed the teaching of Paracelsus, who was a radical alchemist and hermeticist of the 16th century, 15th, 16th, and Paracelsus refuted that idea and talked about, well, was the first that I know to talk, as I did, about the influence of the planet Earth, but not the influence of the external planets. In Planetary Tantra, in the GNE, you're learning that the external planetary system, apart from the sun, moon, and Earth itself, is an archontic framework of celestial mechanics. I'm the last person in the world that would try to persuade you that the human animal is influenced by these archontic factors, and that is why astrology works. No, astrology works because the essence of life in the cosmos is rhythm. And the astrology chart is a pattern of frozen rhythms. So if you know how to unlock those rhythms and see how they flow, then you can read the astrology chart dynamically, and in that way, you can read the rhythms of life as they operate and incorporate themselves into the pattern of experience of a human individual. So the secret is that rhythms inform the astrological paradigm, and it is the rhythms that account for the fact that astrology works as a psychological profiling tool, and much more as well. And I would also go so far as to say, to complete this small digression, that rhythm is also the secret to reincarnation. Or maybe reincarnation is the secret to rhythm. In any case, the two are intimately related. And your understanding of that is imminent, as is mine. Because I tell you, I don't teach you what I already know, do I? I teach you what I am learning in real time. Our understanding of reincarnation comes in the 60 series of these talks. And it is yet another revelation of divine imagination proceeding from the eye of the bull. So on that note, let me update the crew and anyone else who cares to listen to the temporal parameters of the current briefing. We are currently in the Chinnamasta shift that began on the 11th of April, 2013. During that shift, in the fifth day, there was a lunar apogee event in 28 degrees of Gemini, with Jupiter at that time moving forward now. Jupiter is now moving forward after having completed its five-month retrograde period. And Jupiter has now advanced to 15 Gemini. We use the sign language, which is an astronomical grid on the ecliptic, in order to locate the planets precisely. But when we use the sign language, we visualize the constellations. So 15 degrees of Gemini, the current placement of Jupiter, puts it right at the forehead of the bull, right at the root of the two horns. And so the teaching that I am currently transmitting is a teaching about the power at the root of the two horns. Meanwhile, the lunar apogee has advanced to the degree of 28 Gemini. This was on the 15th of April. And that was an apogee moment. And that point, as you will know, is equivalent to the star Sharatan at the tip of the southern horn of the bull in close proximity to the Crab Nebula. So, as I noted in the previous talk, the lunar apogee of the 15th of April marks the coming of the symbiont. And in the framework of the GNE, you encounter the presence of the symbiont, and you understand this presence in a completely new manner, freed from any conditioning or confusion out of the past. I've explained that confusion regarding the way that the Aeon Christos came to be confounded with the Messiah figure that was so avidly awaited in the Piscean Age, at the dawn of the Piscean Age. At the dawn of the Piscean Age, human species fell into a trap. It fell into a setup. The preparation for that trap occurred in the age of Aries, the ram, when the ideology of the Messiah emerged, and the ideology of the Messiah emerging out of ancient Hebrew religion took on the form of a phantom or fiction in human imagination. That fiction is a toxic fiction. Just as you today, as an individual, can have in your mind paranoid and destructive notions which are toxic to your body, so the human species at that time became infected with a toxic fiction of the Messiah. No Messiah, note, go study it, go look at the evidence of history. No Messiah who has ever been promised to come has ever come. And examine the destruction and the insanity and the division of peoples, even within their own religion. In Islam, for instance, the division between the two branches of Islam are based on a dispute about the Messiah, aren't they? The division of Jews and Christians is based on a dispute about the Messiah. No Messiah has ever come. The Messiah is a toxic fiction that produces enormous damage in human society. And unfortunately, that Messiah figure in the early centuries of the Piscean era came to be associated with a genuine cosmical reality due to the intercession of the Aeon Christos. And today, with the coming of the symbiont, humanity itself arrives at a moment when it is possible to transcend and overcome this confusion and to purge that toxin ultimately from the system, to purge it from our system as a species. April 15th of 2013, a moment, by the way, attended by another horrific event of deceit and violence in the United States of America, you will notice, perhaps more and more clearly in the future, that these attempts of the perpetrators and psychopaths to keep humanity in enslavement coincide with the breakthrough moments of planetary tantra. That was a memorable day. Coming ahead in this Chinnamasta shift from the 11th of April, there was a perigee shift on the 27th of April in 5 degrees of Sagittarius at the head of the Scorpion. Now, it's true I haven't spoken much about these perigee hits in the Scorpion. I've been mum on that subject. You could say that I'm in close counsel with the Scorpion on that matter, and when the Scorpion is ready to speak, then the Scorpion can speak for itself. Now we're moving into the month of May. It's the 1st of May, and a little more than halfway through the Chinnamasta shift, which ends on the 10th of May with a new moon in 20 degrees of Taurus, which places it squarely in the constellation of the Ram. Remember that in the GNE and planetary tantra, the exact position of the new moon, which is invisible but can be determined from an ephemeris, denotes the end of a Dakini shift. So, almost without exception, the exact moment of the end of a Dakini shift can be determined by looking at an ephemeris, and that in this case would be the 10th of May. Following that, and coming up in the 12th and 13th of May, if you have the ideal viewing perspective, if you have the proper horizon, and if the conditions of the sky are right, there is a Jupiter-Moon conjunction in the horns of the bull. That conjunction would be the signal of the next shift. Whenever there is a shift in the constellation of the bull, two Dakinis are involved, one being Bhuvaneshwari, or simply Bhudevi, and the other being the wrathful green Tara, also called the Selector. And then, finally, looking ahead to the end of May, on the 27th or 28th of May, again, given the right viewing conditions, this is an event that will be visible, I would say, for no more than half an hour at sunset, maybe 40 minutes at the most. And that would be the glorious sight of Venus and Jupiter, and also Mercury, in the horns of the bull, at the horn tip of the bull, in close proximity to the Crab Nebula. And at that moment, Mars and the Sun will be converging in the area of the Pleiades. So there's very little distance from the Pleiades to the horn tips of the bull. It's about 28 degrees. So that conjunction, when it appears, will be very low on the horizon and only briefly visible in the subliminal zone of twilight. So this is a summary of the current time parameters of the GNE. Now, I'd like to return to the opening moment of the GNE on April 11th. I've often said that in my experience of transceiving Dakini instruction, I have undergone a terrific burst. I have detected, would be a better word, a terrific burst, a terrific intense compressed burst of Dakini instruction in the initial moments of a shift. Bear in mind that for the first day and the second day sometimes, and into the third day of a shift, the dark of the moon still prevails. So the moon is not visible. The sunset crescent is not visible until it separates to about 18 or 20 degrees from the sun. And that will take generally about 40 hours. My experience has shown me that the Dakini instruction begins with a burst. It comes on immediately. The moment that the period of the preceding Dakini ends, the exact moment by the hour and minute of the new moon that marks the end of that shift, the next wave of Dakini instruction commences, and it comes on like gangbusters. It comes on so strong, so fast, and so clear that it can be extremely difficult to retain. I'm currently, let's say, using a certain calculation to understand how to handle Dakini instruction. A miscalculation I would call the load ratio. The load ratio goes like this. Suppose that the rate of Dakini instruction at the beginning of a shift is, let's say, 100 beats a second. I'm not going to say bytes, I'm going to say beats, because beats is rhythm. So we won't use an archonic metaphor. Say that this instruction is coming in at the speed of 100 beats a second. Now that's pretty fast, isn't it? So let's say, let's slow it down. That's too fast for the human mind to retain. Let's say 100 beats a minute. Okay, that's a little over one beat a second. That is the rate that Dakini instruction came to me at the beginning of the Chinnamasta shift. Chinnamasta opened her channel and poured it out. This instruction is in what the Tibetans call non-elaborated thought. It's not the absence of thought, it's a non-elaborated thought. That is to say, it cannot be elaborated because it is already totally and perfectly elaborated. Consider non-elaborated thought to a precious metal like silver or gold that has been refined to the highest degree. So you cannot refine silver any higher if it is the highest degree of silver, or gold if it is 24 karat, or whatever what is the designation for the highest degree of purity of gold. The Dakini instruction from the first moment of the shift comes to you in the highest degree of perfection of thought and conceptualization. You can only receive the thought, you cannot think it. And there's a load ratio involved with the reception. So at the first moment of the Chinnamasta shift, the download was 100 beats a minute, and I could handle 60. So the load ratio was 100 to 60. That's a very, very high load ratio. And I would say that in the first day or two of the Chinnamasta shift, I maintained 100 to 60 load ratio. Now that's pretty fantastic, you can imagine. The problem is that there isn't time enough. No, that's the wrong expression. There is plenty of time. Here I am. I have plenty of time. I'm here in my house. I'm all by myself. I have the company of my cats. I have my day to myself. I can do whatever I want. You can't say that I don't have enough time to write down this transmission. I don't have enough speed in the writing act to get it down. I can't write that fast. And so I found myself at the beginning of the Chinnamasta shift in a situation that a Telestes or Turton may often encounter. I was getting more instruction than I could transmit. So there's also a transmission ratio. You could say that I have a transception ratio of 100 to 60, which is extremely high, but I only have a transmission ratio of 60 to 30. So I'm only transmitting half of what I'm receiving. I was so excited by this initial burst of transmission from Chinnamasta that I attempted to transmit it orally directly onto a briefing, but I just couldn't do it. I had to step back and level off a bit. So I level off then for the rest of the shift at a load ratio of about 100 to 20 maybe. See the difference? And at the same time, I retained that the high, high grade intel that I received at the beginning, which was It's totally astonishing. And this is where sobriety comes in. So sobriety and patience. And I do still have some patience left. It surprises me, but I do. Through sobriety and patience, you can retain this material. And eventually you get it down in a form written or spoken that is intelligible to other human animals. And this is exactly what I'm doing in this briefing. Let me go back and recall those initial moments of this Chinnamasta shift and then come forward to the intel that I have retained, which is the intel that I can now transmit in a sober and cogent manner. I had up until now felt a certain precariousness regarding Chinnamasta. In my previous experience of Chinnamasta transmissions, I had been laid flat, and this is not a metaphor. It's like being laid flat. Sometimes I have to lay flat on the floor, on my back. And Chinnamasta is one of the Dakinis who lays you flat. I would compare the frequency of her clairaudient transmission to something like a high, high-pitched keening of pipes or of the language of birds, very high language of birds. Now, I don't actually hear that in my head because you don't literally hear that sound in your head. You hear it in the silence in your head. And this kind of high bird-like tweaking and keening sound represents the highest level of Dakini instruction that comes out of the entire group of infernal bitches. And there is a euphoria and a state of delirium you reach upon being receptive to such frequencies. Such frequencies bear down directly into the human animal, into your physiological and chemical makeup. That is why they have been called Dakini nectars. You see, a Dakini nectar, where is the nectar? Well, the nectar is in your body. And the human body, the body of the human animal, and of all animals indeed, is sensitive to these frequencies of the earth, of the planetary animal mother. And when you're in the range of these frequencies and you receive them consciously, when you invite them, when you anticipate them, and can know that you are in that flux, well, then those frequencies directly effectuate hormonal, chemical, and neurochemical changes in your body. They affect the endorphins, principally, for starters, and therefore the general feeling and the unmistakable sign that you are in Dakini transmission is that you have a feeling of slight mania or delirium. And I say slight as a cautionary measure. It may be slight and it may not be so slight. So I was in such a state around the 12th and 13th of April in 2013. And I must admit I had a certain apprehension about the Chinnamasta instruction, because in the past she's laid me flat. Each of these Dakinis has her specialty. Now, I do know from previous experience what is the specialty of Chinnamasta, the self-beheading Mahavidya. I think I've spoken about this on several occasions and written about it on metahistory.org. Let me just briefly reiterate. Chinnamasta concentrates uniquely on teaching and demonstrating the dynamics of the central channel. Now go and do some search on the central channel. This is a concept that is shared by Hindu yoga and also shared by the practitioners of Hindu yoga and also the practitioners of Tibetan yoga or Tibetan Buddhism. In the old yoga system, such as you would find, say, in the writings of Woodruff, the serpent power, there is a description of the subtle anatomy of the body as having a central channel called Sushumna, with a right and left vein called Ida and Pingala, right? Do you know that? The central channel goes up the spine, but it is not identical with the hollow spinal channel. It is the subtle counterpart of that, so the old teaching goes. And then in a snake-like configuration on either side of the Sushumna are the currents of the Ida and the Pingala, which go up to a point at the bridge of your nose, and then like the head of a cobra, which is leaning downwards, when a cobra stands on its tail, its mass of its body is vertical, and then the head of the cobra leans slightly downwards as it's ready to strike. Likewise, the two currents of the Ida and the Pingala go downward from the bridge of the nose into the nostrils, and that's where they terminate. So you have the model of the upright cobra. The base of the cobra, its coiled tail upon which it stands, is the base chakra with the 3.5 coils of Kundalini. Then the body of the cobra, and then the hooded head of the cobra coming down into the olfactory organs. Very important detail there, my friends. So you have the classical model of subtle anatomy, and then, of course, you put the 7 chakras on there like beads on a string. So you string the 7 chakras on the body of the cobra. And the traditional yogic process of raising Kundalini in the body, which is called Sat Chakra Nirupana, is extremely famous, as you know. It's also extremely obsolete. Now, in the Tibetan system, corresponding to this, they have other teachings about the central channel, and the teachings about the central channel in Tibetan Buddhism are extremely elaborate and arcane, and there's a lot of coy and arch game-playing around this. Chinnamasta blows all of this away with one burst of her cobra's venom into your veins. Chinnamasta teaches that the central channel with its 2 side veins is not in you anymore. You are in the central channel. And so her teaching immediately leads to a recognition of what I have called the primary method of identification of species designed by the planetary animal mother. What is that? How does the animal mother identify and track the species in her own body and in the habitat that she provides for humans and other animals and insects and snakes and fishes and birds? How does she track these creatures? By rifling. You have your rifling in the geomagnetic body of the mother, the biogeomagnetic aura. And each individual human animal has its own rifling, whereas other species only follow the rifling of their species. This is an instruction of Chinnamasta. So up until April 2013, I had been accustomed to receive this instruction from this Mahavidya. It is a powerful and indeed overpowering instruction. When she shows it to you, you're in it. When you're in it, you're in pure dynamics of an animal in the body of the animal mother, and you can't think. You have no head. All you can do is feel and know intuitively and instinctively that you are alive in a greater and everlasting medium of life, and you can't figure out how it works, even though it's working through you at the instant you see it. And having been somewhat accustomed, although he can never become accustomed to these things, accustomed to the teaching of Chinnamasta, I expected pretty much the same thing to happen. I expected her to come on strong and provide more instruction on her speciality, which is the central channeling, central channel, and the rifling of the bioelectrical magnetic field of the earth. Well, to my great surprise, Chinnamasta revealed in those early days that it was her sublime wish to forego that teaching. That is to say, to forego her specialty and to teach something else instead. And what she showed me, and this probably happened in less than 5 minutes, though it's taken me now, a good 20 days to put it together conceptually. What she showed me is that when she puts aside her teaching, when she forgoes her speciality, she demonstrates her privilege, which she called her glory. "This is my glory," Chinnamasta told me. "My glory is that I can put aside and forego this teaching in order to present another teaching." And she does that in her dedication to the wisdom goddess. It does not mean that you cannot receive the specialist teaching of Chinnamasta. It's always available, and especially during her shift. It takes an extraordinary degree of concentration and, let's say, concentration and intention to hold on to that teaching. But there are special cases, Chinnamasta explained to me, when she enters her glory, which is to provide a teaching for human animals at large. Bear in mind that her specialist teaching is pretty intense instruction. When you have the experience that you are in the central channel, then you start to experience what right and left actually are. You start to experience the dynamics of attraction and repulsion. When Chinnamasta takes you through that lesson, you experience that the supreme law on this planet to follow, the supreme law for you as a human animal to follow, to realize your highest wishes and desires as an animal, is the law of conduction. It is not the law of attraction, falsely taught in New Age spirituality. It is not the secret of attraction. You do not receive the fulfillment of your wishes and desires as an animal merely through attraction. Because in Chinnamasta's teaching, attraction and repulsion are balanced. They are shown to be complementary. And right down the middle goes the current of conduction. Conduction is the highest secret taught by Chinnamasta. And she shares that secret with Idris, designated by the constellation of the twins. So Chinnamasta gives you or imparts to you the instruction on the law of conduction, a high, high Dakini teaching. And Idris shows you how to use it with another person. And once you have the law of conduction mastered in your own energy system, if you will, the next step is to practice the law of conduction in the buddhi system of Tantra, and everything spreads fractally from there. So this is a sublime, magnificent, astonishing, beautiful teaching that is part of planetary Tantra, part of the treasure trove of the Terma of Gaia Awakening. And as wonderful as all that is, Chinnamasta showed to me something equally wonderful. And I'll paraphrase. It's as if she said, "You know, John, this central channel stuff and this magical mastery of conduction is not for everybody. Good many human animals can't handle it. And so my instruction is out of their reach, but my glory is to bring to them an instruction they can reach. And now I give it to you." And this is Chinnamasta's glory. It is the new calendrical, rhythmical coordination of the human animal to the planet. In this instruction, there are two phases. One of them is the restoration of the calendar of planetary and Gaian rhythm. This is simple. This is a very, very simple instruction, even though it comes from the Dakini of the highest instruction of the highest complexity. It's a user-friendly and generically oriented instruction. Human animals can restore themselves to a harmonious rhythm with the planetary animal mother by following a planetary calendar. Chinnamasta instructs on the construction of the planetary calendar, which has two aspects. First aspect is that you crank back all of the seasonal moments designated as first day of summer, first day of fall, first day of winter, first day of spring, by 6 weeks. Doing so, you come back to what the Celts celebrated as the cross quarter days or midpoint moments of the year. Go investigate the names of the Celtic festivals of these midpoint days. The festival of the spring, or the 1st of May, is called Beltane, and that is the day on which I speak. And in the Gaian planetary calendar, Beltane is the first day of summer, May Day. The following day, equivalent 1st or 2nd of August, also has a Celtic name, Lugnash, from the Celtic god of light or the solar deity, Lug, L-U-G-H. Lugnash is the first day of fall. Fall begins around August 2nd. The next day, as you know, is 31st of October, 1st of November, the Day of the Dead, Halloween. This is Samhain. Excuse me if I pronounce it incorrectly. My Celtic is a little rusty. My Gaelic. And that is the first day of winter. Winter begins on the 1st of November. And so the 21st of December is the midpoint of winter. It's not the beginning of winter. The Gaian planetary calendar makes absolute sense in terms of the human animal's natural instinctual responses to these cycles. Finally, Imbolc, Celtic name for the festival of candles, February 1st or 2nd, that is the first day of spring. So the first step in attunement to Chinnamasta's teaching, which is her glory, is to speak among ourselves and celebrate the seasons in this manner. I celebrate with you today, Beltane, May 1st, the first day of summer. When June 21st or 23rd comes, conventionally designated as the first day of summer, you will know it is the midpoint of summer, or midsummer, as Shakespeare knew, and of course lots of people have down through the ages. The second aspect now, what is the second aspect of this new calendric orientation? That is what you are already learning by the following of the lunar shifts. By observing the lunar months, by observation directly, visual observation of the appearance of the sunset crescent, attune yourself to the monthly cycles of the year, the monthly cycles linked to menstruation, as you know. This is a subject upon which Chinnamasta also has some specialist teachings. And so that's it. And anyone can do that. And these calendars would not be difficult to construct, would they? This phase over from the conventional civic calendar, which is tied to Christian holidays, those horrible events of the year that anyone in their right mind has come to hate and detest, Easter, Christmas, and so forth. The phase over from that horrific device to the true Gaian lunatory calendar is an easy one. You don't have to turn your back on that. If you have to go to Dennis on a certain day in May, like Tuesday the 7th of May, you can mark it on your calendar, and you can use that calendric device for coordinating yourself with civic activities, civic and social activities, because the world at large runs on that calendar. But simultaneously, you can phase into the Gaian planetary calendar by observing these new initial dates for the four seasons and by following the lunar cycles and constructing your own calendars based on those two parameters. And finally, Chinnamasta adds as a lovely little piece of instruction, if you will. She adds this reminder. The Gaian planetary calendar of the four seasons beginning on the cross quarter days has no new year. When you phase into the planetary calendar that restores your life rhythm as an animal to the greater rhythms of the planetary mother, you no longer experience a new year. Just consider what that means. There is no new year. There is only the constant and perpetual recycling of the seasons, rhythm without beginning or end, rhythms of everlasting life, no new year. No longer do you have to anticipate that moment of the new year. It's meaningless. There is no new year in this calendric system, which is Chinnamasta's glory, or part of it. So I got this instruction in a flash on a ratio of 100 to 60 download, but I couldn't stabilize the transmission download until now. So now I impart to you what I myself am in the process of learning, and there's more. Chinnamasta teaches that those who enter planetary tantra would do well to observe the ancient paradigm of the 16-petal rosette. The mystery cells were established on that model, The rosette represents the activity of the mystery cells. At any one time, there were 8 initiates, or telestai, male and female, who carried on the inner workings of the cell, auditions of clairaudient teaching, the divine methesis, instruction by the organic light, the activities of God-making, that is to say, realizing the divine potentials of human endowment, the rituals of magic, and sexual and erotic illumination. That's the 8 of the inner petals. But then in turn, those 8 turned outward, and each had one outer counterpart. And the 8 outer petals represented the function of the mystery cell to present teachings to the world at large. Likewise, comprised in Chinnamasta's glory is a teaching about the Gaian planetary calendar that belongs only to the telestai. It does not have to be known or understood by the world at large for human society to realign itself to the greater rhythms of this earth. Chinnamasta instructs that there is no new year. From this point on in your life, there will never again be a new year. But those who are initiated into the inner secret of time, into the deeper studies of time, can designate a point in cosmic timing that would mark a new beginning. Now, when I got this teaching, I was stunned. And I saw immediately what she indicated. I saw it immediately, but I couldn't think it. I couldn't conceive it. I saw something inconceivable. So inconceivably beautiful and simple and elegant, and of an intelligence that is more than human. And Chinnamasta must have known that I couldn't conceive what I saw. And so she said, and here again I paraphrase, okay, I can see, John, that you can't really get this right now, even though you did get it, but that you got something that you can't conceptualize. So I'll tell you how to conceptualize it. Go and find the moment when there was a new moon in around 2 or 3 degrees of Taurus. Go and find the most recent moment when that happened. And then she instructed me in a particular calculation. And she said, make this calculation on the basis of that moment and see what you find. And she left it at that. What Chinnamasta was doing in her glory, in her privilege of presenting to the human species the methodology to realign itself entirely with the higher rhythms of life in the planetary body, what she was doing was giving me an instruction clairaudiently and subliminally, which I was then able to prove objectively. And how that happened was completely amazing. I'll just recount it to you as it came down. There I was pondering this conundrum and the lovely challenge Chinnamasta put before me. And after reflecting on it for a few days, I brought it up in a conversation with Kundry, and she said, well, how would you determine that? And I said, well, you know, these points float around. I observed many years ago, for instance, that when you watch the lunar cycles month by month and you observe the new moons, you'll find that they recess backwards through the ecliptic degrees or through the astrological signs. So typically, for instance, if there is a new moon in 10 Gemini, then the following moon in Cancer will be in 10 or 9, and then the following moon in Leo will be in 10 or 9 or 8, and then the following new moon in Virgo and in Libra will slowly recede. And what happens is that the position of the new moon in each of these 30-degree sign sections slowly moves backward over time. And it takes about 2 or 2.5 years for a full recycling of these lunations. So this is a pattern I'd observed, you know, many, many years ago, and sort of registered it and filed it in my mind. So now I was discussing it with Kundry, and she said, well, how specifically can you locate a lunation in 2 or 3 degrees of Taurus, as Chinnamasta indicates? And I said, well, I can't go to it directly. I'd kind of have to interpolate it. I'd just go back and look at a certain date, say 10 years ago, to see where the new moon occurred in Taurus, say in the year 2000 or the year 2010 or something like that. And I would, by seeing where it appeared on those times, I would gradually be able to approximate the moment when it would fall in 2 degrees of Taurus, because it would recede back. There would be a new moon in 30 Taurus, then in 28 the next year, then in 27 the next year, and eventually it would recede back over a number of years, and it would fall in the area she indicates. Oh, okay, well, take out the ephemeris and sitting there. Oh, I guess I'll just take a stab at the year 2000. Well, I look at the year 2000, I look at the month of May, and lo and behold, there is a new moon in 15 degrees of Taurus, right in the middle of the sign. Oh, well, that's obviously not it. So what if jump ahead to 2001? Ooh, wait a minute, 2001. There's a new moon in 4 degrees of Taurus. That's really close. Maybe that's what she meant, but no. The key instruction is extremely precise. She said in 2 or 3. I wondered why she said in 2 or 3, but that's exactly what the instruction sounded like to me. So I said, oh, I guess it's not that. And so at that moment, Kundry perks up and she says to me, well, why don't you look in the 3 years? You know, look in the initialization period, rather than going back in the past and randomly groping around or interpolating from some particular new moon in the past, but just see if there was anything like that happening between March of 2011 and March of 2014. And so I riffle through the ephemeris. I come to the year spring 2012, and I look at the month of April, because the sign Taurus, the sun enters the sign Taurus on the 20th of April each year. And so the new moon must occur on the 20th of April, which would be a new moon in the first degree of Taurus, or in any one of the succeeding days. And what do I find? I find that there is a new moon somewhere between the 2nd and 3rd degree of Taurus on the 22nd of April, 2012. What do you make of that? I can interpolate in my mind, you know. I mean, she must know how my mind works. I mean, honestly, Because when I look at the actual exact degree here, let's say, here it goes. Well, on the 22nd of April, 2012, the sun at midnight is at 2 degrees and 16 and a half minutes of Taurus. And the moon at that exact moment is in 9 degrees, 48 and a half minutes of Taurus. So I would have to crank back about 7 degrees or 14 hours to the moment when the sun and the moon were exact in the same degree. And some 14 hours before, the moon would have passed into the between the second and the third degree of Taurus. I can see that just at a glance by looking at the ephemeris. So after taking a pause to recover from that shock, which is to say an objective verification of very low statistical probability in astronomical calendrics of a subliminal instruction that I received, I proceeded to go on to the second part of the calculation. And Kundry said to me, well, how do you do that? And I said, well, that's how we determine how this moment of time in correction right now is rhythmically associated with the moment of the end of the kalpa, which is the spring of 2216. And Chinnamasta said that the telestai have the responsibility to calculate the timing that is the synchronization of the planetary Gaian year into the precessional day of 26,000 years. Do you see that? Now, obviously, that synchronization of 1 year of human time to 1 day of aeonic time establishes a new year point in the entire cycle of aeonic time, doesn't it? Can you see that? It is the role of the telestai and the timekeepers of the society, who are specialists, to establish that moment of a new year. But it is not necessary for the people in general to observe a new year. In fact, it's better if they don't. Nevertheless, the affairs of the community and of the tribe, the affairs of the nations, the affairs of the human species itself over the long term have to be observed in a time frame that is reliable and consistent based on a new year point. And Chinnamasta gave me the initial instructions of how to establish this new year point. Now, I'm not going to repeat these instructions verbally to you right now. I'll put them down in writing. So those of you who are interested in seeing them and may want to take up this study yourselves and pursue it further can do so. I assure you that these calculations are not difficult. They are subtle, and no astronomer in the world would ever have even thought of making them. But they are extremely simple, and they are based on transtemporal or diachronic permutations that require simple mathematical feats of addition, multiplication, and division, and nothing more. So I'll put that technical part of the instruction from Chinnamasta into writing and include it in upcoming crew notes. And I'll devote the remaining 5 or 6 minutes of this briefing to the significance of this calibration, what this calibration means, and why this calibration is important. This calibration I consider to be one of the paramount responsibilities in my role as a Turton and timekeeper. As a teacher of planetary tantra, who has had the unusual privilege in my life of studying these time cycles, I am now prepared to calibrate the temporal coordination that links the 3 years of correction now transpiring to that moment when the kalpa ends in the spring of 2216. Why make this linkage? Why perform this arcane act of terrestrial celestial coordination? Well, the answer to that question comes when you really see the scope and magnificence of Chinnamasta's glory. Remember that she forgoes her specialist teaching in order to present to the world at large a non-specialist teaching. And the purpose of the non-specialist teaching is so that human animals living in communities and tribes now, at this critical moment in the history of our planet, can re-coordinate themselves to the rhythms of nature, can re-enter again the dance of Pan and the harmonic coordination of human life with planetary life and the life of all species. In her instruction, Chinnamasta shows that the Aeon Sophia herself has an enormous task facing her. Sattva is the key to what goes wrong with the human calibration, with the endowment, the seven-point endowment of the Anthropos. Sattva is the coordinating factor in the endowment. Sattva, or rhythm, is what allows the seven factors of the human endowment to operate together harmoniously. If that rhythm is broken, then gradually the interaction of the seven parts of our endowment, the seven divine talents, breaks down. And gradually, which is even worse, and this happens in the conclusion of Kali Yuga, the capacities of that endowment individually themselves break down. Hence a degeneration, a marked degeneration of human behavior, a marked increase of ignorance, a marked decrease of intelligence, because the calibration, the individual seven divine talents are breaking down because their coordination broke down, because the rhythm broke down. And the rhythm of the human calibration can only be sustained within the larger rhythms of the planetary animal mother herself. So it's an old story, isn't it? It's a fancy way of talking about something that happened and has been happening now for some centuries. The human animal has fallen out of harmony with nature. The rhythms have been broken. But it's worse than that. It's far worse. Because the human animal is such a powerful player in this experiment, when it broke its rhythms in coordination with the life cycles of nature, it became capable also of disrupting those life cycles themselves. This is how powerful the human animal can be. If it has to be demonstrated to you in the negative, then it shall be so. And so, the planetary animal mother has herself sustained enormous damage to her rhythms over the past 200 to 300 years since the rise of the Industrial Revolution. That is clear as day, that destruction, that disruption and alienation from nature at all levels is clear as day to anyone who has a grain of intelligence left to see it. But there is a solution to that terrific planetary disruption of rhythm. And Chinnamasta's glory is that she holds that solution open to anyone who would receive it. And in that way, She serves, although I rarely use this word in Planetary Tantra, as you know. In that way, she serves to assist the great challenge facing the Wisdom Goddess. And what is that challenge? Well, from the moment of completion of the initial conditions of correction, Gaia Sophia has 202 years to restore and re-coordinate entirely the totality of all the life cycles operating on this planet into a synchronous perfection. A synchronous perfection of harmony. And that task begins at the completion of these initial conditions. She makes the initial conditions perfect. She is making the initial conditions perfect. And you are the witness to that. You are the witnesses to the Nahual of the Wisdom Goddess. An aeon can only commence an experiment, or in her exceptional case, correct an experiment by establishing perfect conditions. Once those initial factors are in place, the Aeon Sophia has 202 years to entirely restore the rhythmical integrity of every single life cycle on this planet. And it is Chinnamasta's glory to oversee that process and to make it available to the human mind. And so, she still retains her place in the cycle of Dakini rhythms. And each season of the year in the spring, when the lunar omens indicate, Chinnamasta comes on shift with her specialist instructions. But all throughout the year, that is the year with no new year, and all throughout the cycling seasons from this moment onward, she teaches the adjustment and synchronization of planetary rhythm. This teaching is an instruction for groups and communities. It is mundane. It is a teaching to be demonstrated in the construction of new calendars by hand and in the observation of the seasons and the lunar cycles as indicated. And anyone can do this. That is the first act and the generic act, if you will, of attunement to the synchronization of planetary rhythms. And the last thing I would like to say in this briefing is not to be taken as a prediction. So don't think the navigator predicts. Don't even think that the Turton predicts. The navigator anticipates that as the breakdown in the rhythms of life and in human alienation from the greater rhythms of this planet reaches its shattering and shuddering conclusion, which is happening right now, at the very same time, the Nav anticipates that the evidence of the resynchronization of all of those broken rhythms begins to reveal itself. The two events happen at the same time. And I ask you, as we together undergo the final year of this experiment, to attune your observation exactly in that direction. Day by day, the evidence of the final and catastrophic breakdown of the rhythms of nature is evident, isn't it? The birds falling from the sky, the beaching whales, the beaching dolphins, the loss of the bees, the collapse of the bee colonies. You could make a list of 100 events that demonstrate that the dystrophic feedback has reached the level of catastrophe. But I anticipate that at this very moment that happens, the beginnings of the syntropic feedback can be observed. And you, in this experiment, and you in Planetary Tantra, are the first to observe them. So observe well, and observe with love. And when you observe this particular phenomenon of regeneration on the planet we inhabit, bring to those observations the gratitude that it merits, the gratitude to belong to this experiment, and the gratitude to Chinnamasta for the demonstration of her glory. You can call her Mirita.